work and whatever, and those of you that had to travel over the pass, I appreciate you making the effort today, and I would like to especially recognize the committee administrator John Hauser and his assistant Mike Riley. They left Salem at 7:30 this morning and went all the way through the gorge just to make sure they could get over here on time. I'm Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54, the City of Bend, and it's a good pleasure to be here. I think that these field hearings have been extremely beneficial, not only for us, but more so for you. It gives us an opportunity to come out here and we don't have to come to Salem. Unfortunately, as you can see, the other committee members didn't make it over, and I think it had something to do with studded tire fees or something. They are on the phone, however, and I'd like to ask them to introduce themselves. Terry?
Yes, this is Representative Terry Beyer, and I am from Springfield, and I'm sorry I'm not there in person, but I'm happy to be joining.
Thank you, Jerry. Is anybody else there with you?
Dave is supposed to be coming on. He isn't here with me.
Okay. Before we get started on the agenda, I would also like to thank the Chiefs County for making this room available. It's a very nice facility and convenient. We appreciate that. I also want to recognize some of our local elected officials and other distinguished community leaders. First of all, Chiefs County Commissioner Dennis Lewis.
Representative Martin.
Hello,
Representative Thatcher. Oh, hi, Representative Thatcher. You are on and we can hear you. We have just started the hearing about 2 minutes ago.
Thank you.
Commissioner Luke and the Chiefs County Commissioner Mike Daly and then Mayor Bill Friedman. And Redmond Mayor Al Unger, Crook County Judge Scott Cooper, and Bend's Police Chief Andy Jordan in the back. So welcome, everybody. Kim, we were just doing some introductions. Would you mind introducing yourself, please?
Absolutely, Mayor Burley. My name is Representative Kim Thatcher. I am from Kaiser, Oregon, and also represent Newburgh and St. Paul. I have a background, in fact, my business does a lot of work with road and bridge contractors around the state, and I'm familiar with that aspect of ODOT, and enjoying the committee work dealing with one of the other issues that ODOT deals with, and the whole transportation industry.
How it works together, and it's been
a great experience. I appreciate being able to contact you by phone since our
roads were
passable today.
Okay, great. Thank you, Kim. Folks, our agenda today is we're going to have an informational meeting first. We're going to have some representatives from the Central Oregon Area Committee on Transportation, and Judge Cooper is going to give us a presentation on Milliken Road. Then we'll open a public hearing. We've got four bills that all deal with the school zone speed limits, and we'll just have a public hearing on all four of them together, so you don't really necessarily have to focus on any one of them individually. We also have a proposal that we want to lay out and get your thoughts on with respect to the school zone. We've had a work group on it that's come up with some ideas, so we'll lay that out for you also. Then we'll have a public hearing on House Bill 2655 that deals with a group license plate to promote prevention and suppression of wildfires. Then after that, a public hearing on 2742, establishing Safe Routes to Schools Fund. Representative Boone, welcome to bed.
All I can say is that currently Representative Boone has never looked better.
And there is no snow in the past. I'm here to
tell you. Did you hear that? The pass is dry.
Oh, great.
Would you like to introduce yourself, please?
I'm Deborah Boone, State Representative from House District 32, which is the upper left coast. Happy to be in Bend. Yes, no, I couldn't even use my
And I'm Senator Ben Westland from Senate District 27. By consensus, the bestest, greatest, mostest, just all around best Senate district in the whole state.
At least you said it was Dress Center Vision. Did somebody else join us on the call?
Yes, this is Representative Dave Huff from Clackamas County.
Hello, Representative. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. Thanks for joining us. So, folks, with that, we'll go ahead and open the informational meeting on COAC to start with.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Luke, Deschutes County Commissioner from Deschutes County. I'm Scott Cooper, County Judge from Cook County. We have several other members of COAC here today, and include Mayor Friedman, Mayor Under, various distinguished members of the community, which is Jeff Munson from New Options. Who else did COAC? Hold on. Our temporary manager.
Thank you.
So the Area Commission on Transportation is made up of the three counties, between Cook and Jefferson County, plus all the cities in those three counties. And we meet every other month, unless the legislature passes additional funding, so we've got to get down and prioritize projects, and we meet more than that. We have put together a needs list, and we have shared it with our legislators, local legislators before, and we've brought enough copies for the committee. Most of the projects on this needs list is on the list because they're not funded. These are the long-term projects in all of our cities and in the three counties that need to be done, but there simply aren't enough funds, and we're not unique in that, you know that. I think one of the neat things about the COAC, which is different than how it used to be in our relationship with ODOT, is that we are now in an advisory role. We have really good open lines of communications with them, except on a couple instances when they try to dictate to elected officials how we're supposed to have our Area Commission on Transportation set up. But we've been able to convince them that if they wanted to go this way, they'd be going on their own, and we would no longer be an advisory committee. It's been a very good experience, I think, with ODOT. It's really opened up the process, talking about projects, being able to prioritize projects. And I really like the way the three counties and the cities work together. The reroute in Redmond is an excellent example. Judge Cooper has major projects in his county that need to be taken care of. Jefferson County does, Deschutes County, all our cities do. But the reroute in Redmond was the number one project for this act. And consistently, as they knew, that was the major bottleneck on 97. That's being taken care of, and that's taking care of a new project that we need to the top. But I really like the cooperation that we have in the act and the way we work with ODOT. Welcome.
I would just add to that, there's complete agreement with everything Dennis said, because there's no point in not agreeing with everything Dennis said. And point out that the cooperation with the ACTS extends beyond the borders of Central Oregon and three counties. We also collaborate very closely with the ACTS to the north and to the south of us, which comprise the entire ODOT region. We meet with them. And probably annually, sometimes more often, depending on what's happening in the funding cycles out there. We worked out a joint recommendation on our project. It has been very successful. It is frankly a mystery to us as to why some regions of the states are having such a difficult time putting their acts together and having such a difficult time coming together and talking about what is good for their regions in addition to what is good for their communities. We have seen the regional interdependence in this community for so long that we hardly know any other way to do business. So it is a huge success, at least here.
Thank you. Any questions?
Well, just a comment, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you guys and compliment you. It's a mystery to us why there isn't more collaboration in some regions. You guys did your job and very diligence and passion. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wesson, one of the reasons we learned to cooperate over here and collaborate so closely is usually we're going against the legislative process. And so this is an extension of that.
Well, I would like to compliment you, former representative. You're one of the individuals that taught me that it's as a legislative delegation, we learned you operated the team, and that always was an effort in various settings in the House District. So, you know, it's a concerted effort. Thank you.
I hope, Mr. Chair, I hope the people on the conference call realize we're smiling.
Those on the call, any questions?
No, this is Terry Byer, and I the only thing I want to say is that just make sure everybody talks into the mic.
Okay.
So it'd be easier to hear.
Very good, thank you. Nothing wrong?
Okay. Well, I thank you again for the opportunity to appear before you again today, Mr. Burley. Mr. Yeoman is my representative. I'm very proud of the work that he does representing Cook County. This, of course, is normally the committee that he chairs, and I know that he regrets that he cannot be here today. But we certainly appreciate those of you who made the arduous trek over the pass, with or without studs. Those of you who had studs, I'm sure, got here easier.
And safer.
And safer. And I hope that you will, I hope today that I will be able to give you an opportunity to hear about something that went right in Oregon's transportation system. Far too often these field hearings turn into an opportunity for people to tell you everything that went wrong. We have a story out of Crook and Deschutes counties about something that went very, very right, but which also provides a cautionary tale, which I think might be of interest to all of you as the key policymakers who, in this state, must lead transportation policy. The project I want to discuss with you today is the story of the Millikan Westview Road. On the back of my testimony that I've handed out, you'll find a map, and it shows the location of this road, which is just to the, starts just to the west of Prineville on Highway 126 and connects after about 30 miles to Highway 20, out about 28 miles to the east of Bend. The road in that area has been there since the early 20th century when it was initially surveyed by Crook County Surveyor George Millikan. It was a principal road at that time for farm-to-market produce activities, Prineville being the only center of any significant commercial activity in this particular region, and Bend and Redmond generally being unheard of at that point. That has, unfortunately for Prineville, changed in the last 80 years or so. And the road was built and was very well put together after the construction of the railroad, essentially along the Deschutes River, that brought Bend and Redmond to prominence. The road eventually began to die out, but it was still there, abandoned, but not necessarily forgotten. In the early 1990s, the then Crook County Roadmaster Norm Thompson began to promote the idea in Crook County and over in Deschutes County that perhaps there was an opportunity to hard surface this road and upgrade it and create a better connection that would relieve some of the pressure on Highway 97 and create a more logical transportation route from Portland into Southeast Oregon. The road actually shortens the distance, and given the congestion on Highway 97 through Bend and Redmond, it shortens the time by about 60 minutes if you're commuting from Burns to Prineville. So he tried to pick up some traction on that. He sold his idea to then Crook County Judge Dick Hoppus, who handed it off to his successor, then Crook County Judge Fred Rogers, who gave it to me when I took office in 2001. The gentlemen that were involved in that process were required from the outset to engage in a process with the Bureau of Land Management, which controls about 15 miles of the land through which the road passes, and most of that land being located in Deschutes County. That's where the principal obstacle came in, because try as they might, the Bureau of Land Management couldn't figure out a way through their rule book to allow the counties to proceed with a cooperative project to hard surface an existing road. This was either a violation of the National Environmental Policy Act or a violation of the Federal Land Management Policy Act, and it simply couldn't be done. In about the year 2001, the BLM entered into a planning process, the Upper Deschutes Basin Resource Management Plan, and we saw an opportunity, and we jumped right on that to say, okay, now is the time to work through all those policy issues, get it in the plan, and get the job done. So we commenced that effort. We had a lot of leadership from around the region. Commissioner Luke was very, very involved and supportive of that. Bill Friedman, Mayor Bend, was very supportive. Al Hunger, Mayor Redmond, was very supportive. All that project, by the way, was coordinated at the COAC level, and we spent much time discussing how it might be done and why it would be useful to the region to have a bypass through 97 and to be able to bring more economic activity coming through our region, and how that might benefit all of the communities of our district. And we all strongly supported it, unanimously supported it in a formal resolution. We also, at that time, were, as you will recall, 2001 wasn't particularly a good time for any of us. We were entering the recession. We were beginning to feel the effects of the recession. We were concerned about picking up business. We were particularly concerned in Prineville because we have a little company there you might have heard of. It's called Mushwap Tire. They sell studded tires if you don't have any yet. And that company was, as it has grown, beginning to have some issues with being able to reach the outlying areas on its service territory from its location in Prineville, and was making noises about needing to find a new warehouse location in the middle of California somewhere or in Nevada. That didn't sound like a very good idea to us at all, since about 900 jobs in Prineville were dependent on the Westlaw Tire Company. We had at that point about 5,000 total, so 900 going somewhere else, or unfortunately that 900 just kind of hurt at some level. So that kind of sped up the whole discussion about the need to get a better transportation route out that would connect us straight into Highway 20 and Point South and allow them to work within that 10-hour time frame when truckers can drive before they need to stop and take a break. And so we hit again on the idea of the Millican Road. We advanced various conversations about what might be done with that road with the BLM, and after 1 year, we finally threw up our hands up in the air and decided maybe this was not the way to go. There was simply no way through those policy books which the BLM kept throwing on the table. It was clear it wasn't going to get done. So with the full consent of the BLM, the best way to get this finished was to go straight to Congress. We literally went and asked for an act of Congress to grant jointly to Cook and Deschutes counties a right-of-way through the BLM for the existing Millican-Westview Road that would allow us to upgrade. And the President of the United States signed that bill on December 19, 2002, House Resolution 4953. It was sponsored in both the House and the Senate by Senator Wyden and by Representative Walton. It was the House bill that passed out first. So that's the one that went to the president's desk. And we had our right of way, and we were elated, and we were ready to go to work and get this done. We even had the funds to complete the job because we all have access to the county payments bill, the dollars which have been granted to us for at least some time by the federal government to those lost timber receipts. We had a coordinated agreement between the chiefs and Cook counties on how to pay for it, and we were ready to build. ODOT was very excited about it, not only because it was looking at opening up another opportunity for a new transportation route through the region, but also because since 1969, ODOT has been seeking an opportunity to be able to replace Highway 27, which passes from Prineville south to Highway 20 and is one of the last unpaved highways in the state of Oregon, with a better, straighter, shorter paid route that would eliminate everything from congestion on Highway 97 to air pollution to reduced fuel consumption. It was straight. It didn't run through a wild and scenic river corridor like Highway 27 does. There are a million reasons why this is a better road than what the existing designated state highway is. So ODOT worked very closely with us on trying to figure out the plan to put the Millican Road together. We also had the support of Oregon Transportation Commissioners, Gail Ackerman and Randy Cappé, who frequently attend our COAC meetings, who were very supportive of the whole concept. ODOT and the counties came together, did the initial studies, determined we would be able to take 81 trucks a day off the Highway 97 stretch between Bend and Redmond, which would be a substantial improvement to the capacity and functionality of that highway if we built it. We all figured, we had estimated independently, the county and ODOT, that it would cost about $5 million to build it. But all of our estimates came in within $200,000 of each other, so we were very comfortable with those numbers. And so we were thinking this was a go, and we were going to be able to do something good for the state of Oregon. Then we sent the ODOT agency folks out to do the consultation process with the federal and state land management agencies. Now, I don't know if you know how much about how the consultation process works, but you ought to know more about it. Because what they do is they have to go around and talk to everybody who might have an interest in the land and ask them what they'd like to see for environmental protection in the project that is proposed. And everybody at this point gets to cork it up with everything that they ever wanted to do and couldn't get anybody to agree to. So here's an example of some of the things that ODOT got back to us with at the end of the process and said, this is what we'd have to do in order to build it. We'd have to do a two-year study of deer, elk, and antelope migration patterns across the road involving radio collaring various animals and counting how many times they crossed the road. We'd have to do a six-month study of the existence of toads and tadpoles in seasonal water ponds at the roadside in the high desert. We'd have to do a $500,000 study of the potential impact of the road construction on the fisheries in southeast Oregon as a result of increased access to those fisheries. We'd have to construct a 12-foot experimental fence the entire length of the road to public land intended to prevent mortality to deer, elk, and antelope in the area. By way of answer to a question, we said, where does this other 12-foot high fence exist in Oregon? We were told there isn't another one in Oregon. In fact, the closest one is in Banff, Canada, but we thought we might want to replicate that experiment. We would have to construct a tunnel beneath the road every mile for 12 miles to allow animal and OHVs to pass under the road surface. We would need to somehow figure out how to get electricity in each one of those tunnels and light them so that things lingering in those roads wouldn't, or in those tunnels wouldn't eat the things that were entering those tunnels. At a cost of $150,000 apiece, we would have to relocate 6 PPA high-power transmission towers to prevent the lines from drooping too near the road at high points near the road bed. The total price tag for the project, when we got all done with all these requirements, had grown from $5 million to $37 million. We listened as politely as we could. We thanked ODOT for its input. And I want to emphasize these were ODOT's ideas. This is the collaborative input process and what had been gathered up as they talked to the other agencies and what had been requested. And we said, we think we'll build the road ourselves, because we think we can still deliver it within the $5 million estimate, and we can protect the environment. So we went out, and we hired our own consultants, cost us $70,000, because we wanted to do it right. We wanted to make sure it was a quality project, and we don't want to harm the environment. So we didn't think we needed all the things we were being asked for. We said, go out there, no pressure, no instructions, tell us what's out there that would be harmful to the environment and what needs to be done to mitigate it. And our consultant, who was Karen Swirsky and David Evans and Associates, came back and gave us a good, thorough report on what we needed to do. So we cut the junipers and the sagebrush back a little farther than we would have from the side of the road in order to make sure that there was adequate sight distances and that the animals could be seen and could see the oncoming traffic so that we wouldn't have the animal mortality. We excavated the roadbed down instead of moving the poles so that the road wouldn't be high enough where it could reach the BPA towers. We walked along and looked for evidence that there had ever been any seasonal ponds full of tadpoles and frogs and found none. And we excavated 3 tunnels underneath the road, which we didn't like. They were for OHV crossing. We found no dead carcasses in them since we built the road. And we also put up some signs at the other crossing points for the OHVs and for the animals.
Were those animal carcasses or human carcasses?
We found neither, actually. And so without those modifications to the project, we went ahead and we built the road. And we came in under budget and on time. The total project cost was about $4.6 million. We got all done. We put fencing all along the side. It wasn't the 12-foot fencing. It was the wire fencing on the Crookhand side. The sheep fence still working on that. And we opened the road in July 2003. Instead of the 81 trucks that we had anticipated would use the road, we've actually, by our hand counts, are seeing between 200 and 300 trucks per day, which are using the road as a cutoff from Portland going to southeast Oregon. We have seen the opportunities that we had hoped for in terms of increased exposure of our area to potential economic development projects that are coming through, finding that we have plenty of available and affordable industrial lands in our area and are purchasing, bringing the businesses here. We've had zero wildlife mortality, and we are tracking that. And it's a very, very successful project, and it's an enhancement to the Oregon transportation system using the county roadway.
Representative Gilman asked me to come today and make this presentation to answer the simple question, what is the true cost to Oregon of its current program the way that Oregon does business? And I am here to tell you today that based on this project and this project alone, the cost of doing business the Oregon way is a factor 7. As policymakers, I think that's something you should think very carefully about, because we as Oregonians all want to have a quality transportation system, quality of life, and a quality of environment. We really want it all. We can't afford to have it all the way we do business today. I think with some simple modifications to the system, some common sense approaches, there is a chance that we can come much closer to having it all. And I think this project presents some wonderful lessons in how that might be done. So I thank you for the opportunity to present this to you. It's food for thought. It was a pleasure to work with state agencies throughout the process, and it was certainly informational for the counties, the cities, and for the entire region, as well as for our state. I hope it will be education to you as well.
Thank you, Judge Cooper. Any questions?
Just a comment. Scott, thank you very much for that presentation, and I want to underscore your point of common sense transportation priorities and environmental sanity, but also thank you for reiterating that delightful story that some of us have heard as an investigation you all went through. It's quite incredible, and we really
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one thing I want to point out that I don't think is emphasized enough, we found out during this process that the state environmental standards are higher than the federal Department of Transportation standards, and I'm not quite sure why. And so hopefully, maybe in the interim, the committee could take a look at that and find out why that is. The other thing is, I've been very actively involved in the Sun River interchange, the new interchange at South Century Drive going into Sun River. And the environmental process on that drove this whole project and probably extended it a considerable length of time. We all know when you extend a project, you increase the cost. And I don't want to say that environmental standards aren't important. They are. But why are the state standards higher than the federal standards and drive the cost of these projects up? It's amazing.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would want to add, too, that I don't want the takeaway from this conversation to be let's go beat up ODOT some more. ODOT is responding to the mandates that have been handed to it by your predecessors sitting in the chairs you sit in now. The agency is doing what it can do, and the agency is cooperative with us throughout this project. But we seriously need to look at the process and not look for victims, but look for the root causes of why we're in this situation.
Well, it's interesting that, and first of all, I do want to commend not only the counties, the cities, federal, state agencies, Congress. It was a real team effort, and I sat on the sidelines and watched, but we had quite a few conversations over this, and what you did was a pretty commendable effort. It's interesting you mentioned the idea of having tunnels under these roads, and we may all snicker about that, but in fact it came to our attention here 2 months ago that in a highway improvement project out near Tollgate near Elgin in Northeast Oregon, to mitigate the potential impacts for a species listed under the federal threatened and endangered for the ESA, the Endangered Species Act, they did, in fact, put culverts under the road for this Canada Lynx that doesn't even exist out there right now to be able to cross without getting run over. And that added on some cost to the project. So we are hearing this, and this is something that's on our agenda to take a look at.
Judge Cooper, Mr. Chairman, there's a case that they didn't tell you that while they were going out and doing the collaborative process, the coyotes came forward and said that they liked those tunnels because they could bring deer in from one end and catch them in the middle coming from both ends. So,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the other example there that's informative for you, I think, is a tunnel is not a tunnel, it turns out. The tunnels that were originally specced for the project were specced at a cost of 450,000 pieces, I recall. The culverts that we eventually put in were about 80,000 pieces. Three culverts.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I know you have another bill coming up. And Senator Westland mentioned that I used to represent District 54, and it's with great interest I've been watching the speed zone, because I dealt with that in 97 and actually got the definition, my committee got the definition into law about when children are present. What I've read in the paper, the only thing I would suggest is that children are around those schools more than just during the week. You being on the Parks and Rec Board know that there are a lot of soccer and other events that happen on weekends with a lot of kids around the school. So it's important to have a good definition of children in the present.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2365, 2041, 2827, 2840, the school zone speed bill.
Mr. Chair, these bills approach the school zone issue in a somewhat different manner. The committee has already held two hearings in Salem on the subject and received extensive testimony. A work group has been operating in recent weeks to try and come to some type of consensus as to an approach to address the concerns that I heard at these public hearings. In the back of the room, we have a copy of an amendment that has been drafted to create a different approach to this subject. Representative Beyer has been very active in the both the activities of the work group and the development of this amendment, and she might want to explain its genesis to the group.
Representative Beyer?
Yes.
Would you please?
My favorite subject. I did get assigned leading the work group to try to come up with a solution. Work group included cities, counties, I have to remember the traffic control devices committee had representatives, Portland, the bike, Scott Fricker with the bike group, Kevin Campbell with the state police were all involved in it. It was very difficult to reach consensus on issues. We did come up with a couple of proposals that I'm going to be, which we took into a different meeting. The proposals came out of our discussions but hadn't necessarily been agreed upon by all participants. And one was kind of an option that was standard around the state. The other one was an option that set up some parameters but allowed local jurisdictions to post these within those parameters. Then I think there was some concern that we weren't making enough progress, and some sponsors in the parent city wanted to pull some members together to see if we could sit down and find something. So with Representative Gilman, Representative Berger, Representative Burley, Representative Barker, Representative Jensen, myself, and Representative Richardson was coming but didn't make it until we were pretty much done. So he said he doesn't know what happened in the meeting. And they just determined they wanted to go with an alternative that came out of the committee, but it was a standard time period, and they did do some adjustment to it. So what the amendment should do is, the first thing they should do is that flashing lights will supersede in all situations. Now, there's a question of whether or not in the amendment that's happening, and we're going to have to figure it out. And so, flashing beacons, the speed will be uniform around the state in this amendment, and that is from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. on days school is in session, is what the amendment will say. There's been an issue with adjacent and non-adjacent crosswalks. There was some talk in the work group about combining them. The group of legislators wanted to keep them separate to get that where it is now, which is when lights are flashing or when children are present. So, and these options are regardless of what the fee is. The posting is 5 to 7 in all fee zones. So this came out of a group of legislators. The amendments have been drafted, and we're floating them now to see what kind of comments we're going to have on them. So I'll let you take over.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Representative Byer. Are there any questions on what she asked before we start taking testimony for what she reported on?
Sure, Bert, could you clarify those points you made before this time?
When Representative Byer was talking about a street or a school zone adjacent to, we're talking about a street that's adjacent to the school, the property of the school is. We don't have much in this city, but I did notice in Salem they have quite a few school zones that are 3-4 blocks away from the school, mainly for crosswalk things. So when we're talking about adjacent, we're talking about the streets that are right immediately adjacent to the school. And it would be from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. on school days, unless there were flashing lights. So, for example, if you had flashing lights and you had an evening program and wanted it to be 20 miles an hour from 7 to 9 p.m., you could turn the lights on from 7 to 9 p.m. In a non-adjacent school zone, which is particularly these identified crosswalks, it would either be when children are present or when lights are flashing. That was what the changes were being drafted on right now. So that, you know, if you want to think about that when you come up to present your testimony, we certainly appreciate your thoughts on that. Okay? And so with that, I'll call our first speaker, Deborah Hogan.
Chair and members of the committee. My name is Deborah Hogan. I'm the State Communities Coordinator for the City of Bend in the Engineering Division. I'm here to speak about the school zone legislation and also to support safer school funding. You kind of threw me for a loop with that very last statement, which really got me thinking about the non-adjacent or when lights are flashing, and I'll try to address that at the end of my comments. I would like to explain a little bit of my background and why I'm here today. I've been involved in children's safety and transportation safety for 20 years as a volunteer, as a member of the school board, and for the last 9 years as a City of Bend employee. Our traffic safety committee in the City of Bend supports children's safety. Our Bend Fire Department has the Central Oregon Safe Kids organization, and we put a lot of resources into trying to protect children's safety, particularly within school zones. I was involved in the ODOT committee that prepared the guide to school area safety several years ago in 2000, and 2 years ago when Central 179 passed, we were faced with the challenge of how to make that very complicated law into something simple and effective for the City of Bend. What we have done is we have only two types of school zones. The at all times as required for adjacent school zones for speeds under 30, and 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. for all other school zones. We don't use flashing lights. We don't have, when children are present, we simply have those two types of school zones. I take our children's safety very seriously and very personally. I appreciate the commitment of the Bend City Council and the community supporting us and allowing me to be here. And I'm also very grateful for this subcommittee's attention to this very critical issue. And I have three issues that I'd like to speak to. First, the flashing lights. The Bend Traffic Safety Committee has a long history of making decisions and recommendations based on current traffic data, best engineering practices, research, and a good judgment developed by a diverse and involved committee. When the flashing lights were first made an option within school zones, we conducted a test of two locations, one with flashing lights and one without. They were on similar urban roads, both adjacent to an elementary school. The tests were done over a period of a year, and we tested the traffic speeds and volumes 4 times. At the end of the test, we found that the speed within the school zone with flashing lights was higher in all instances than the school zone without the flashing lights. Therefore, we made a decision that flashing lights for the City of Bend are not appropriate on our urban roadways. regarding this school zone, and I'm just going to give you some background and I'll come to a conclusion at the end of my remarks. Regarding school zone dates and times, again, the city of Bandy researched actual times of school activities. Classes actually begin at 6 a.m. at our high schools, especially our alternative high school and middle school. Study groups begin at 6 a.m. or earlier. The children have to be there. Activities and campuses that serve middle and elementary schools are jointly located within Deschutes County, so you can have a 6 a.m. study group middle school, followed by 7 a.m. start of school, 9 a.m. start of elementary school, 1 o'clock lunch because we have open campuses, and kindergarten release at 1, and then after school activities that are completed by about 6. Based on a survey of all of our public and private schools within City of Bend and Deschutes County, we decided that 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. would best protect our children and serve at a time when they're most likely to be in front of the school. We recommend that a consistent time be selected for each jurisdiction, whether that be decided by the county or the school district, so that drivers can anticipate what the times on the signs are going to be and won't be subject to reading the small lettering that's below the speed sign. Finally, I just very briefly want to touch on funding, because I know there are many others here who are going to address their passionate need that I share for funding for school zone safety. The City of Bend has tried to combine and maximize and leverage the dollars that we have to get safety control. We've used waterline projects and expanded pavement to add a little bike lane here and there. We've tried to take our capital improvement program projects and make sure that they include safety for children wherever possible. With that funding, we've also taken ICT grants and ODOT bicycle pedestrian grants and applied them around schools exclusively so that we maximize safe routes to school for children. But a dedicated source of funding for school safety would be greatly appreciated. Finally, in conclusion, I would like to say flashing lights in school zones should be allowed but not required. School zone time should be flexible, or if not flexible, we would by far prefer school days 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Safe routes to school funding should be distributed to local communities and used to remove barriers to safe walking and bicycling to school. And finally, and I see this in the amendment, which I deeply appreciate, as school zone rules are changed, please include an effective date that gives us 6 months to implement and allow us to do a public information campaign to educate our community. And finally, if I could just go back to the chair's comment about the IMJs and school zones, when flashing all the children are present, will not allow us to use our 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. rule that we are now using. And since we have found flashing lights to be not effective in improving safety for children, we would prefer on first glance not to be limited to those two options in how we use school zones.
Any questions for Deborah? And Wesley?
Yeah. Can I just go over the hill on NEP sector, please?
And on that road, you have Jupiter Elementary and Middle School.
There are flashing lights there, sir?
No. There, we actually have two school zones there for elementary school and middle school. It is 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., and we have crossing guards for both the elementary school and middle school.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking. Maybe that's why it's so effective. Electric times. I like that 6 a.m.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
And I apologize too. I forgot one thing. We try to bring people up that have traveled more than 100 miles for this. Scott Bricker, I know that you're going to testify on the subsequent bill, so I'm going to hold off on you. But Randy Woolley and John Oshel, if you would like to come up now, since you've traveled so far, you may come up next to that list. Okay. Thank you. Next, Christy Munson.
Thank you, Chair Burley. I just happen to have a mayor with me here today, Mayor Alan Unger.
Yes, Alan Unger, Mayor of Redmond.
welcome Chair Burley and committee.
Members of the committee, the Legion participated on the work group. We appreciate that work group and appreciate all the work that your committee administrators put into this. And having said that, my city, Christy Munson with the League of Oregon City, thank you. And also for the record, the League has not been able to fashion a solid position on this subject, but we do have three things that we would hope the committee would include in any bill. One, our city's strongly desire that flashing lights would trump all. Flashing lights are incredibly expensive, and for those cities who've made that investment, we ask that the flashing lights be able to trump all. And frankly, in the work group, and from what I've heard, I don't stand in opposition to that. I just want to mention that again. Secondly, I've heard from my traffic engineers and from my public works people that if you do put together something that would require us to change time, we have 6 months extra. There was a run on time, and we had a very difficult time getting time. So if you could delay the effective date, that would be very helpful. And thirdly, something we always mention, and I know you were expecting to hear it from me, but if you do have us change signs, if you could consider very respectfully adding some funding for that, we'd be very much appreciative. We've had to go through and change signs once already, and we know you understand the economic hardship. Having said that, I'll leave you with Mayor Unger.
Well, thank you for Mr. Chair Burley and committee. Thank you for considering changes to this type of law. I know in our discussions at Central Oregon City's organization meetings that the mayor of Prineville has said that there is a 20-mile-per-hour safety zone down through the middle of downtown Prineville on Highway 126, which does create challenges to the city. What I'd like to see is some state standards, but some local flexibility. I think that as we travel around the state, it's difficult if the law changes much from one jurisdiction to another, so that, you know, we're creatures of habit. I know that there are times when I'll go to a meeting just because I'm used to it in one meeting place, and lo and behold, it changes to another place, and I just, early in the morning, don't think about it. Funding. I think most of the cities in Oregon are small cities, and every dollar counts for those small cities. I know when we had discussions on state revenue sharing, I was surprised to see cities like Petolius and Cobra without state revenue sharing. That's a big portion of their budget. So any cost is a cost to small cities. Flashing lights, I know there's one at Prineville, Powell Butte between Redmond and Prineville. It makes you realize that there is a school crossing there, so it adds attention to them. Redmond School, High School has early bird classes that do start at 6:30. And I just wanted to say I like the committee's suggestions, and I thought Deborah McMahon had good comments. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Andy Jordan. Chief Jordan.
Chairman Burley and committee members, welcome to Bend, and thank you for being here this afternoon. My name is Andy Jordan. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Bend. I'll keep my comments short this morning, or this afternoon, actually. First, I truly appreciate the work you're doing on this bill. We've been struggling with school zones now for a long time, and I think we need to figure out what we want to do, make a decision, and keep it in place. We're confusing the motoring public. As you look to make a decision, I would ask that, number one, we always keep in mind why we're doing this, and that is for the safety of our children and our communities. Sometimes these discussions get out of whack. We start looking at local control versus state control and having different rules in place for the state. But let's always keep in mind that it's the children we're here to protect. And we need to be fair to the motoring public. Taking a common sense approach, I really believe that we need a statewide rule that is in place for everyone. It's extremely difficult for law enforcement to have different rules in place for different communities. I think the current situation that we have is a very good example of that. You can drive through the city of Bend in a school zone at 3 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and you're not going to get stopped by a Bend police officer for going 30 in a regular 30-mile-an-hour zone. And in other places in the state, that is not the case, whether there's children there or not. I hope there's not children at 3 o'clock in the morning. So I think having a statewide standard is very important. And, you know, it's one of those situations where the public really doesn't always understand how the rules are formed or where they're formed and by whom. And one of the things that law enforcement runs into in trying to do our job is that many people in the public believe that we make the rules. And so if in the city of Bend we have one rule and in another city in the state there's a different rule, and a visitor from another city comes to the city of Bend and we impose our rules that are different from theirs, who takes the heat over that? The police do. And again, from my perspective, a little help there would be important. I've looked at just the last few minutes, the changes in the rules. I truly believe that all of these ideas are good. I think that having one time, I think 6 or 7 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon is a good time. I believe that in the areas not adjacent to school zones where we have sidewalks or crossing areas, that children present is a good definition for us. I'm not particularly leaning on either side whether lights are the right thing to do or not. And maybe we need to leave the lights to local control as long as that situation is a statewide rule that everybody understands. So if the lights are on, that means you go 20 miles an hour. Again, let's just take a common sense approach to this and make sure that the motoring public understands the rules in all of our communities, and they don't have to guess. They can drive into any school zone in this state, and they know what the rules are. That makes them enforceable, and that keeps our children safe. That's all my comments and the questions.
Any questions? Well, I just appreciate Andy's perspective. I mean, all the good rules we make, the bad ones they make. I think that's fine.
Well, we can make our own bad ones.
Yeah.
Okay,
well,
thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative Byer?
Yes.
And I just wanted to comment on something that he has said, and that is that I think the fact that we just keep moving the goalposts and changing is very confusing, and hopefully we can get something else that we can all live with and that people will soon be able to adapt to.
Thank you for that comment, Representative Byer. Next, Gary Judd.
Deschutes County Traffic Engineer Woman. I'm not representing necessarily Deschutes County today. I have served on as president of the Alliance for Community Traffic, ACTS, you probably know that. I've been chairman of the Oregon Traffic Control Devices Committee, and I was a member of the ODOT School Zone Task Force a couple of years ago when we put together the guide. In my position as county traffic engineer serving on these safety committees, I've given you an awareness and sensitivity and opinions of how motorists and pedestrians perceive school zones. Over the last 6 years, we've been discussing changing the speed laws concerning school zones and how best to sign those zones. I've had many meetings with union members, not necessarily about school zones, but it seems to refer to that often, with police officers, school officials, statewide safety groups. what has come out of that is the perception of drivers and law enforcement officers, and that seem to be pretty similar when I talk to them, and that is, you see your children there, you must slow down. And also, flashing lights are very efficient for slowing traffic down. When there's limited sight distance, especially in high-speed state facilities, it works real well. Of course, adult crossing guards work the best for slowing traffic down or controlling children. In regards to other types of sight school zones, my experience does differ a little with some of the other agencies. Deschutes County only has three roads that mark 20 miles an hour at all times. One in Terrebonne, one in Pumala, and one in Lapine. And I've never received a complaint about those roads. It's been up for nearly 2 years, and when we put up a traffic control device, especially regularly, I generally get some phone calls, maybe. On the other hand, we have a couple old school zones in place from 6 to 6 years ago. These have generated quite a few complaints. They seem to be generally dealing with the difficulty with the signs. They do not reflect the activities at the school. There's inconsistency statewide in the hours. And in many times, there's communities go through them every day and never see children in the school zone. They don't have the ultimate suggestion on how to solve the sight in school zones. It's difficult to find a single sign or group of signs that will fit any situation. My suggestion would be let the road authority decide which of the signs would be best and how to sign that specific school zone. And those would be when children are crossing, the lights flash and all times, all the time. The local road authority can do that with the help of the PTA school officials. The other point here is the definition of children present. We changed that 4 years ago, actually, and I don't believe it's really worked out real well. I'd like to adopt more of the Washington type of definition, which is when children are occupied or walking within the crosswalk, children are waiting to cross, and on the curb or shoulder, or children are present, or walking along the roadway, either on the shoulder or over on the sidewalk within the school zone. Using that definition, or one there about, would be more precisely what the people perceive it to be, and pretty much what these Deschutes County deputies are doing, issuing citations for. Thank you for listening to my comments. Any questions?
Any questions? Representative Byron. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Thatcher.
My only comment is that I can't hear very well for some reason. This makes sure people are talking to me.
Okay. Apologize. I'll do that.
Thank you.
Gary, I appreciated your kind of specificity with regard to where children are on the sidewalk approaching in the crosswalk. Clarify a whole bunch of stuff. Thank you.
Oh, okay. I did attach the Washington law.
Randy Wood.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Randy Wood. I, too, am a city traffic engineer rather than county. But today I'm only representing myself because there's not been an opportunity to discuss this with the council. As a traffic engineer, I've received a lot of feedback in the last 2 years, like Gary, from citizens and drivers in my community. I've also had the opportunity to hear a lot of discussion about how it works and what it should be. Serving on the Drug and Traffic Control Devices Committee, and more recently on the working group that was chaired by Representative Byer last week. And through that long process, I've looked at all the different drafts of the bill, and I've kind of wavered back between a number of them, back and forth. But after pondering all the input I've heard, I conclude that House Bill 2365 was the one that had the right concept, probably. I understand the goal is to make things simple, make things consistent statewide, and I conclude that that bill gets no better than the other draft I've seen. It says basically that if you can have flashing lights, or if you don't have flashing lights, then it's going to show no present. The flashing lights are important to us in my community because they work well, the citizens like them, they're very understandable, and they're easy for enforcement for the police because it's clear in the scheme that's in effect. And the other thing is that we have quite an investment in flashing signals as some other communities do, and we'd like to be able to use those. And with the at all times, we weren't quite sure how to use them, so we actually had to take some out 2 years ago. There's been discussion of hours, the posting hours, different hours. And originally in the discussions, I was following in a camp that said you should have let the local road jurisdiction set those hours. Because it's quite clear that each school zone is different. Schools operate different hours, have different situations on whether they're close to the road or far from the road, a number of different issues. But I decided, you know, that doesn't get you to the goal of clear and simple and consistent, because we're going to have different hours in every zone like we do now. On the other hand, the complaints about the existing law, the 24/7 at all times, that I've heard, especially in 30-mile-an-hour zones, is it doesn't make sense to the drivers. They say, why should I be going 20 miles an hour down this arterial street when it's the middle of the day and the kids are in school, and we do have closed campuses, so there's nobody there. And I'm afraid that setting hours and saying that all schools zones will work for these hours will be the same situation. So I don't think that gets you to the goal of appearing consistent and reasonable to your drivers. On the other hand, when children are present, and it would need the definition would be tweaked a little bit, I think that is clear to people that the definition is written carefully. And I would support the type of definition that the judge was just advocating. He basically, if they're in the school zone, the children are walking along the road, or crossing the road, or waiting to cross the road. That means that children are present at the school zone. I think that would be clear to drivers. And we put that variability of the schools across the state, because the schools where the children only come in the morning and leave in the afternoon would be covered. The schools that maybe have children coming and going at different times throughout the day because of kindergarten or different classes go at different times, they would be covered too. And I know that for enforcement, my police might like it more specific, but I think if we got to this definition, they could take it up too. And finally, I'd like to reiterate what Christy Monson said. The effective date is important to us. The last time we started the RIP, because it seemed like every road authority in the state ordered new signs at the same time. Our crew was ready to go before school started 2 years ago, and we couldn't get the signs. I'd like a little different approach. I like the effective date of July 1st, so that the things that we can implement, we could go ahead and implement. I'd like to see something in the bill, no matter what you adopt, though that gave us 6 months to come into compliance. So that's my proposal to you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Scott?
Chair Burley, members of the committee, I hope everyone can hear me. For the record, my name is Scott Bricker. I'm policy director at the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and also work with the Atlanta Pedestrian Coalition, so bicyclists and walkers. I want to first thank Representative Beyer for chairing the working group, and I think that the working group was making some progress. There were probably maybe two major camps, but we were moving in direction and felt pretty good about some of that progress. I'd like to report, I had an opportunity to report back on what I think the current Dash 1 amendments, whether or not they went in the direction we were, and also sort of my main concerns and where I'm coming from. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance, along with the Pedestrian Coalition, as it deals with kids going to school, have a primary goal, is to increase bicycling and walking among children. That is what we're doing around school issues, and you'll hear more about that later with Safe Routes to Schools. There are communities around the state, all over the state, that are working to achieve this goal as well. We want to create a school zone bill that provides a high level of protection and safety for those children. Also, that has consistency around the state in the messaging, as we've heard already today. However, I think the main reason why we're here is also something that's acceptable for the motorist public and the general public, so we don't have to come back to the drawing board again in the future, or this situation doesn't come up again. Our perspective is that children will bike and walk to school in places generally where it tends to be safer. Neighborhood schools, lower traffic schools, lower speed locations, and we would like to offer an elevated level of protection in those areas. The bill that built on the Dash 1 amendment, Representative Richardson's bill 2840, offered a 7-to-7 protection on 30-mile-an-hour streets. In my written testimony, I supported the 7-to-7. 6-to-6, if that's the time, that's fine as well. Something that's straightforward, easy for the public to understand, but also protects the most the school zones that are going to tend to have the kids walking to them most frequently. And at the same time, have a rule that doesn't apply all day, people aren't going to be screaming about 2 in the morning and those sorts of issues. As it goes for the higher speed facilities, 35 and above, I think that enforcing a speed, even a 7-to-5 or whatnot, I think there will be concerns from the public. For example, I drove here this morning from Portland. On Highway 97, I passed through at least 2 school zones at Warm Springs and at Smith Rocks, where I would have had to go down to 20 miles an hour. And I think that with the freight traffic and the amount of traffic going on 97, I couldn't imagine people actually abiding 20 miles an hour in those 2 school zones from a certain period of time. And those are areas where I think flashing lights or when children are present would apply very appropriately. And actually, it was mentioned by a couple of different testimonies, there are other, even more effective, can be other solutions such as crossing guards or whatnot. So I'm proposing a solution that really protects the lowest traffic streets, the 25 and 30 mile an hour streets with a fixed time, that allows the higher traffic streets, gives local flexibility when children are present, flashing lights. However, it might be that some communities want to install even a more rigorous standard of 6-to-6 on all streets, and perhaps they should be able to do that as well. I think most importantly is that you give people opportunity to get funding or other resources for other types of programming like crossing guards, things that are really known to be effective. And I think that the Safe Routes to School bill that we'll be talking about later will address that as well. So I hope that that's clear and concise, and I'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Any questions? Thank you, Scott. And last, John.
Chair Burley, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm John O'Shell, County Road Program Manager with the Association of Oregon County. Briefly position before I go into details, the Association of Oregon County is not advocating any specific position. Well, our concern is that we get to a solution, we get to a solution. We cannot keep changing times and changing public expectations every 2 years. In that time, I was one of the people was working with the working committee to try to find a solution. I think they made really good progress. I think the proposal you have with a one-word change that we'll be suggesting is a very acceptable solution. The committee basically was heading towards 3 solutions with the idea that, you know, since we couldn't agree on one solution, give the committee 3 and let them look at public some more and see which way they wanted to go. One concept, to be clear, we were all together on, which is if you have the flashing beacon school zone, the flashes when you need it most,
and then turns off when you don't need it, that is the preferred solution when you can afford it. The concept being that if you just tell people to slow down when they need to slow down, and you do it with bright light, and then when you don't need them to slow down, they can drive at the regular speed limit, we felt would be most popular, most effective, most likely to get people to slow down when they need it. The one concept that did not get advanced to the committee but wanted to be advanced or ran into technical problems was the concept of when children are present. Now, let me break that aside. The when children are present for the crosswalks, I think is effective. I think everyone's agreeing with that. I believe that is working. But the issue on the when adjacent to a school zone, there were a lot of people that liked the concept that says it is always, if you see children in the school zone, you slow down, but then you have this special time if you got that problem, and if you can afford a beacon, you can also, whether they see children or not, you can slow down during those periods when those things are critical. The difficulty is people cannot seem to agree on the definition. You wrote a very good definition, great perspective, very good. Even though some people might know, I hired him for this to tell me about 28 years ago. So we go way back. I have heard about two other definitions that also sound very clear and engaging, but they can't seem to get between the enforcement, the people that write the definition, the judges to concur. If we could ever get everybody on the same page, I think almost everyone would go to that solution. Two other solutions were proposed by the committee with sort of the understanding that we may not be able to get to that preferred solution. And they both are related to, once again, what trumps is the school beacon. We have the phrase that we kept using is we had consensus to the Commonwealth, which is basically everyone on your amendment there agrees with the E, the A that says basically it's a segment of highway designated by the school zone. It's a flashing light controls if it's functioning. And if the flashing light is not there, then you go to a posted zone. And everyone pretty well agreed on that. I will mention my one word correction. The language is written when it was forwarded. When you look at the double I, where it says there's a flashing light described in ORS 811-106 is not in operation, what we forwarded is when it's not in place. Quick technical explanation. Now, what we're saying is if the light, the beacon is there, it controls. If it's flashing, you slow down. If it's not flashing, you can go at normal speed. If you say in operation, then if it's not operating, then you go back to it's 20 miles per hour anyhow. So technically, I think the intent of everybody is that word probably should be placed. If legal counsel doesn't like place, no one has another word that may understand there's legal phrases around legal words, and that might be an issue there, but operation does not work. Relating to the two recommendations, one was to have local control on those zones, but maybe limited to some no more than 12 hours per day, and the other was to set a fixed time by the state. You need, of course, to be aware that working for the Association of Oregon Counties, it is genetically encoded in myself that I cannot advocate anything but local control. But that being said, there is great merit to having one set of times uniform statewide and one uniform set of expectations. If you're listening to public testimony, you can get some consensus as to what those times should be. There is great merit to that solution, which is as proposed, and as I said, I believe would be very acceptable to us. That's all I have, and let me have your
questions. Any questions for John? No? Thank you, John. Well, as many of you can I've heard, people are all across the board on this one. It's been an interesting, this has been the third hearing on these bills, and it's been very interesting. But I will say, and for the benefit of those of you on the phone that have not seen this definition that Mr. Judd provided us from Washington State, it does seem to have some merit appeal to it. So we'll try and get that to you back in Salem as quickly as possible. And Representative Fire, we might want to take a hard look at that. So with that, I'll close the hearing on the school zone speed limits. And we will now open the hearing on Council 2665. John?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2665 would allow ODOT to create a new type of license plate based on working with an organization that would be promoting the prevention and suppression of wildfires. And would give the
the department the option to allow certain phrasing on the plate itself that would promote the notion of prevention and suppression. There's also been some discussion that the plate could include an image or likeness of Smokey the Bear to distinguish it from other kinds of specialty plates.
Okay, thank you. We have a whole host of folks that have traveled quite a distance, including Gary Marshall from our own fire department. But I think Gary will hold off on you. Mary Ellen and Charlie, and was there a panel?
And Gilbreed.
Committee. My name is Mary Ellen Holliday. I'm the president and chief executive officer of the Keep Oregon Green Association. We are 65 years old this year, been around since 1940, promoting wildfire prevention. We are a nonprofit organization. We are managed by a board of 36 directors and 18 senior directors, most of whom have ties to the timber industry in some manner. We have a rather unique mission of making the public more aware and then teaching them how to prevent fires to protect landowner resources. And because of that unique mission, we do have permission from those who manage Smokey Bear to use his image to promote that mission. The task has always been a little bit difficult. It was a challenge to us to just get to the recreational visitors to the forest to remind them to be careful with fire, you know, not to throw out their cigarettes and to be careful with debris burning. But now it's even more challenging because we have more and more people who are moving into what we call the WUI, the Wildland Urban Interface, and that adds additional threats because not only now do we have wildfires that threaten homes, but we have homeowners who may start a fire that will threaten our forests. The point here, of course, is that all of these types of fires can be prevented. The challenge, though, continues. The challenge continues, though, is the demand for the resources is increasing, as is the population in the state of Oregon, and especially that in the wildland-urban interface. But the decline of forest health is also increasing, especially on federal lands. So the need for prevention is critical then to balance these issues. Smokey grew up with most of us, and therefore our children know who he is and what he stands for. For 60 years, Smokey Bear has been giving his wildfire prevention messages and stories that remind us that only you or we can prevent wildfires. Unfortunately, however, many urban kids don't know who Smokey Bear is, as we recently found out when we started a partnership with Big Town Heroes. The managers of Big Town Heroes went home and said, "Who's Smokey Bear?" They said, "We're going to have a partnership with Smokey Bear," and they said, "Who's Smokey Bear?" So it made us realize that probably about 39% of Oregonians from a survey we took really don't know a lot about Smokey Bear or wildfire prevention. So we have another challenge in front of us in the awareness and education in urban locations. House Bill 2655 gives us a greater opportunity to support our mission. Any symbol such as Keep Oregon Green or Smokey's Head will help remind others of their responsibility for wildfire prevention. The income from these plates will again help us increase our marketing message and bring about the behavior changes to our public that will continue to reduce the number of human-caused wildfires. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak before you today, and if you have any questions, I'll be very willing to answer them either now or after your testimony.
Wonderful. I didn't hear the other two folks on the panel.
Chair Burley, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm
Charlie Stone, Protection Projects Director for the Department of Forestry, and also serve as a member of the Board of Trustees for People Irving Green. I want to thank the committee for holding this hearing today. I understand that there are probably another 8 bills in the session this year for groups who would like to get their own license plate or a symbol on a license plate or something similar to that. And I don't know if all of them are going to get to have hearings. We certainly appreciate this opportunity. And I think that our situation is a little bit different, rather than representing the person who drives the car and is a member of an organization or is, you know, a graduate of Oregon State University or supports the donor program, what we're proposing to do with this plate is everybody can get it, and hopefully then there will be thousands of little 3x3 public service announcements traveling around the state of Oregon. And reminding folks, as Ariel said, that only you can prevent wildfires. But with combining that with a marketing effort, we ought to really be able to expand the message to the people in the state of Oregon. Excuse me, I'm fighting a little bit of a cold here. But in my written testimony, I've given you some statistics on the seriousness of wildfires in Oregon, and I don't mean to go over those, but I want to point out one thing, and that is that two-thirds of the wildfires that the Department of Forestry works on suppressing are human-caused, and that means two-thirds of those fires, or about 750 a year, can be prevented. And it's a very expensive business, both in terms of the cost of suppression and also the damages to the owners and the damage to our environment. So any kind of effort that prevents just one large wildfire will be well worth all the inconvenience. We understand that the Department of Transportation is never thrilled with these types of bills, even though they've agreed not to oppose this bill. If we had one significant human-caused fire last summer, the Bland Mountain 2 fire down in Douglas County, that cost $7 million to suppress and caused incredible amounts of damage to young forests in that area. We could eliminate just one of those to make it all worth the cost and the effort and the inconvenience of these. And we think that they'll be very popular among the populace. I did a quick poll just within the Department of Forestry in the last 2 weeks, an email poll, and within a week and a half's time, 23% of the permanent employees in the department responded, and they represented the willingness to purchase some 210 sets of license plates. Now, the Department of Forestry is a relatively small organization compared to the Forest Service, the BLM, the rural fire departments around the state. If we have that level of support through all those organizations, let alone the general public, we think we'll sell a lot of these plates, get the message out there, and help keep Oregon green. Mary Ellen and I have worked with Robin Freeman and Lana Cully from the Department of Transportation on some amendment language. They were concerned about the breadth of the bill as it's currently written. And we believe we've agreed to a set of amendments. We have the -1 amendments, I think, at this point. And they narrow the scope. They make it specific to keep Oregon green, require that the image of smoky is appear on the license plate, and require that we ensure that there's permission to use the image of smoky, which we already have, but we'll follow through. There's just one nit in that set of amendments, the way they're written right now, and we can live with it the way it is if the committee chose. But on the last page, page 4 of the -1 amendments, in section 2 of the bill, it directs the State Forestry Department, in collaboration with the Keep Oregon Green Association, to apply to the federal government. And we really believe that should be the other way around, that Keep Oregon Green, in collaboration with the Department of Forestry. It's Keep Oregon Green's project. They're responsible for it. They'll benefit from it. And we'd like to have that recognition as such. Because of the way that Smokey's use is structured, it's the Forest Service, the state foresters of all the 50 states, and the Ag Council that control that image. So I think there was a concern that it would have to be the Department of Forestry applying for the use. That's not necessarily the case. So we point that out to the committee. Ultimately, we could be satisfied with the -1 amendments, and the department will certainly do what's required of it to assist in this effort. We respectfully request that the committee schedule a work session for this bill, adopt appropriate amendments, and move to the floor of the House with a positive recommendation. Thank you.
Hi, Chairman Burley and members of the committee. My name is Bill Greeley. I'm the current chairman of 240 Green. I'm here today to urge your support for House Bill 2655. People who are involved with wildfire prevention know that preventing wildfires is much more cost-effective than suppressing those already started. We also know that educating people about the dangers of human-caused wildfires is an effective prevention method. But we need to consider whether we should continue to educate Oregonians about prevention using the same methods we have in the past. We believe to achieve our objectives for fire prevention in the future, we need more than traditional approaches. Non-traditional, innovative approaches can reach new audiences. We feel that the Smokey Bear Keep Oregon Green license plate is this type of a non-traditional, innovative approach that will result in greater awareness of the fire problem for Oregonians and an opportunity for all Oregonians to take more responsibility for fire prevention. I urge you to support this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you guys today.
Any questions?
How much does the light cost? I believe in addition to the regular fee of $40, like $54, it connects to 32. Of that 32, Keep Oregon Green would get about 30 minus the 6% that we may be charged by the National Forest Fire Prevention Committee. So about $1.90. We get about $28 out of it.
How much does it cost to template this up in DMV registration and get the program up and going?
Chairman Burley and Senator, we have not gotten a fiscal on that yet, so they're not positive yet how much it's going to be. With this bill, we do have to put $10,000 up front and so 1,000 license plates a year in order to make it work, plus the cost of setup and that sort of thing for ODOT.
Well, it's about $80,000 when you go on down the license plate before. So that's my bad news. My good news is we can borrow that, no kidding, from the lawnmower account, which is where gas tax proceeds go to be held, to be reclaimed by people that don't use gas on highways. They're never totally reclaimed. So we can borrow funds out of that until you can repay. Just a helpful hint from Ways and Means as to how you can actually make this work. If you can sell enough plates.
We're going to get
to
a prayer later.
Come see me. I'll show you how it works.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Out of the others that are on the list, would some of you want to come up together? Mike, Larry, Mike, Earl, and Gary.
Chair Burley, for the record, my name is Mike Bexel. I'm the Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council, OFIC, in Salem. It's a pleasure to come here today. I think the points that Bill Greeley, Mary Ellen, and Charlie have brought forward duplicate a lot of the comments that I have. But also, it's the suppression cost has increased so much, and as you're well aware, the financial situation for the state of Oregon, almost all the available dollars that are available to go towards these missions seem to be going towards suppression. We just don't have a lot of money to share with on the prevention side. Not that it's not important, it just seems that that's where we're having to put a lot of money these days.
And I guess I would really admire the fact that they've come up with some creative way to, number one, generate some more revenue specifically for prevention activities in the state, as well as get the public more involved, educate them in the rural areas as well as the metropolitan areas with the imminent smoking, as well as our tourist population that comes through. When you look at the rock up there, it's a natural, with the mountains in the background, a nice big tree in the middle, and smoking off to the side. Sure, it doesn't get any better than that. Okay. And really, it's the cost of suppression, like I said before, but it's every time you hear something that fire costs $10 million, or Charlie pointed out $7 million for the Blaine Mountain Fire, that's only suppression cost. It doesn't touch the amount of resource loss out there. And when you think of OFIC and other timber companies, you think, well, it's just the timber values. Well, it's also the recreational opportunities for the public. It's the wildlife habitat. It's the air quality. It's the stream quality. It's just the ecological damages are huge with these. And so anytime we can prevent a fire, it makes the most sense of anything. Like I say, I've always came up through the ranks, and the cheapest fire you can fight is the one you suppress. So I'm a real advocate when it comes to that. Like you say, it's also too, Oregon has a proud heritage of natural resource values, and I think this, coupled with the public's increased knowledge of the value of Oregon's natural resources, whether it be for hunting, fishing, hiking, air quality, stream quality, jobs, products, it pulls it all together in a way that everyone can contribute to, because all those things are important to all Oregonians, and it gives them all a chance to participate with. One thing that Mary Ellen said with her latest polling hit me kind of between the eyes as I was driving over here today. My two granddaughters are very, well up to speed. In fact, one of them even has a photo with her and Smokey at the state fair. They know who Smokey is very well. But it bothers me that there's probably more kids out there that know who SpongeBob SquarePants and a few of those other cartoon characters are than someone of value as Smokey Bear. And I think this is a great opportunity to raise that awareness. So I would encourage you folks to support the bill and move forward.
Thank you. So does that mean you oppose my SpongeBob SquarePants?
Sure, Burley and Senator Washington, I think we should talk later.
Chairman Burley and members of the committee and Senator Wesson. I'm Larry Justina from Eugene, Oregon. My family manages approximately 47,000 acres in Mann, Lane, and Douglas County. The name of the company is Justina Land and Timber, and we're located out of my hometown, Eugene. I've been a member of the Keep Oregon Green Association Board since approximately 94, and I am in support of House Bill 2655. Basically, I think everyone has pretty well spoken to the issues. One that I would like to bring up that I don't think has fully been addressed is the fact that Keep Oregon Green has made a great effort in trying to broaden their message, not only to speak about wildland fire, but bring in fire protection and in the full realm of what fire protection needs to be. We have on our board, we have a representative of the state fire marshal's office, as well as an insurance representative, and we continue to try and broaden our message to make sure that we're speaking to fire prevention of all sorts, rather than just purely wildland fire, which is our main goal and purpose. So basically what I'd like to say is we're making every effort to be as collaborative, as comprehensive, and as cooperative as we can in addressing fire prevention in Oregon. And the license plate program, as far as I'm concerned, is an excellent way for Keep Oregon Green to financially expand, to improve, continue its collaboration and coordination, and to spread the message of fire awareness throughout the state of Oregon. I also think that it will allow thousands of Oregonians to actively participate in this awareness program through their display of the Smokey Bear license plate. Thank you very much.
I'm going to defer until my esteemed colleague comes up. I thought he was coming up.
How are you, Earl?
Good. How are you, Senator?
Good.
Chairman Berlin, members of the committee. My name is Earl Cordes, and I'm the fire chief with Jefferson County Fire District in Madras, Oregon. And I'm very well aware of the wildland and woolly problems that we have, the wildland urban interface problems that we have in Central Oregon and in Oregon and the Northwest. I've been fire chief for 20 years and have been dealing with these wildland and urban interface problems since that time. Also, we've been very, very active in the fire prevention co-op in Central Oregon. Smokey Bear has been an icon with the Forest Service since 1944. Today, he's an icon for all fire agencies, not just the wildland and land management agencies. Smokey can befriend an adult as well as a child. Smokey's message is simple, and it's been that way and very effective for all those years, and that is only you can prevent wildfires. We on the structural side have incorporated Smokey in with our fire prevention messages, along with our partner and his colleague, Sparky the Fire Dog. So we go hand in hand together in promoting structural safety as far as getting children out of a home in case of a fire, and also having Smokey right there to talk about not playing with matches and also to be careful in our forests. We live in a fire-prone ecosystem. Major catastrophic conflagrations inundate our state every year. My statistics, we heard nearly two-thirds, and statistics I looked at is nearly three-quarters of the fires in the state of Oregon are human-caused, and that's who we need to direct. We have an increased popularity of wanting to live in the urban, in the urban areas with a natural look and not modifying the fuels. But as we know, that creates a tremendous problem for us. Interface fires are very complex, very dangerous, and very devastating to the resources and to the people that are involved. Not only the local property manager, the local government, and state government. The loss of natural resources and revenues that are continuing to compound our already strapped budgets. Something needs to be done. It needs to change. We need to begin to hold the process. We need to begin the process of holding the public accountable for their own fire protection. We can continue to throw money at suppression over and over, year after year. And we know the key is prevention. It's education. This plate will give us an opportunity to enhance that prevention and education message that we have been promoting for years and years. Smokey is loved by all. His picture will be there for as a constant reminder to the young and to the old. The license plate is an excellent way to introduce Smokey to people who don't know him, as was stated earlier. And Smokey is just another method of getting out the information on fire prevention. I would hope that you, Chairman Burley, and the rest of the committee would support this bill and move it on to the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Chairman Burley, committee members. My name is Gary Marshall, Deputy Fire Chief and Fire Marshal for the City of Bend. I also act as the Vice Chair to Keep Oregon Green and serve on the Governor's Fire Service Policy Council. At this time, and I'm just very fortunate to be part of Keep Oregon Green and what they represent, I am in favor of House Bill 2655 with the amendments as proposed. Wildfire consumes our natural resources, our communities, our way of life, and sometimes even loved ones, as it's been demonstrated not only in fires here in Oregon, but throughout the nation. In 1996, Oregon lost 44 homes to wildfires. 19 of them were just here in the Bend area that summer. It's a very tough time for the residents here in Bend, as well in 1990 when the Aubrey Hall fire consumed 21 homes here in the Bend area. These residents that lost their homes were devastated. Many of them say it's like losing a loved one. We were trying to give them comfort, and then the homes that we were able to protect with our suppression resources, they were actually hugging us. It was very, very compassionate, and it drove me to the point that I felt that we need to do more with public education and prevention. All wildfires do start small. whether it be human or naturally caused. The question is, can we prevent wildfires from starting or growing to an uncontrolled size? And the answer is yes. Can we minimize the cost of state Oregon by preventing uncontrolled wildfires? The answer is yes. Can we change the behaviors of our public and tourists to be safer with fire, to control small fires, prevent small fires that often become larger fires? The answer is yes. Can lightning-caused fires be prevented? Probably not, but can the devastation from lightning-caused fires, and can we minimize those larger fires? Yes, we can, with good public education. These fire prevention efforts do cost money. Safer Corporation teamed up with the City of Bend, Chiefs County Fire District, and other Central Oregon agencies, and infused $150,000 into the Fire Free program. With that Fire Free program, we've leveraged close to $750,000 back into the Central Oregon area to prevent wildfires. It's been going strong for 7 years. So when I see $80,000 that may be infused into this type of program, can we change the behaviors and attitudes of the public? Yes, we can. Wildfire public education programs are our first line defense against wildfire. Smokey Bear has been our National Fire Safety icon for over a half a century. Smokey Bear license plates is an innovative way to collect voluntary revenue to support wildfire prevention awareness and education programs throughout our state. Keep Oregon Green has been a leader in wildfire prevention since the World War II era. I feel that with this wildfire prevention information, it will assist us in protecting our natural resources, it will protect our communities, and it will definitely assist us protecting our firefighters and our visitors to the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Any questions?
Just a comment. I know you guys are really tired of hearing me tell you I'm a volunteer firefighter, too. My husband's a chief, small, unpaid volunteer fire department in my district, and we do encounter a lot of forest land, and it's a big fight factor for us all the time. And I think that the chief said it best, and this prevention is the way to go. And this is all about prevention. And I actually hope I look as good as Smokey as you kind of are. He hasn't changed one iota.
You can stop by any one of the Bend fire stations. We have a life size Smokey out in front of the fire station, any one of the fire stations, and we'll take your picture.
Okay, any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's two others that signed up, and I'd like to ask you're welcome to come up if you've got some new information to add, but we do have another bill that we want to get some testimony on the record for. So, okay. George?
Chair Burley, Senators, committee members. I'm George Chesley. I'm a long-term involvement with Natural Resource Management, some 33 years, 28 here in Central Oregon. The one point that I really wanted to make, in addition to what has already been said, is the rapidity of which we're growing in Oregon. 1990, we had the Aubrey Hall fire. 1996, we had the Skeleton fire. Between 1990 and 1996, Bend grew by 48%. Whenever we get a big fire like we had with Aubrey Hall, there are lessons learned. Half the people that were here for the Skeleton fire did not have those lessons, and that was just in 6 years. We think that this license plate bill allows for a non-traditional way to get to more people. With people moving in, we can't rely on just the traditional ways of getting the message across. This is a way to increase the message and get more and more people aware of just what it means to live in a wild area where wildland fire is a major problem.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Nancy Porter and I live in Portland, Oregon. And I have worked in resource management for 32 years at that office and is still a member of that center here in Central Oregon and in other parts of the country and other states also. And I just would like to reiterate, I guess, one of the things that some of the other folks have said, and that is that fire prevention really is everyone's responsibility. And it takes everyone, the legislators doing their part. It takes the educators in the classrooms, the firefighters. It takes all of the insurance companies. It takes everyone coming together. And fire prevention does work. I have seen them work, and I guess that's just, I'll keep it short. Thank you.
Okay, any questions? Thank you very much. With that, we will close public hearing on House Bill 2655, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2742.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2742 is legislation that would establish a safeguard to school fund. It would authorize ODOT to accept grants, donations, other types of money that might become available from the federal government or from any other source. These funds can be put in the Safe Routes to School Fund, and they can be distributed under provisions of the bill as grants, technical assistance, or offering funds to finance and review of local state, a local government Safe Route to School programs.
Okay, thank you. I apologize for the hour here, folks, so we won't panic. I can tell you that I did visit with Chairman Gilman yesterday, and there will be a subsequent hearing on this bill in Salem, too, so if we don't get to anybody today, there will be no opportunity. And first, I'd like to call Mayor Friedman up, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, honorary members of the committee.
Hey.
Sitting in an audience to testify creates idle time, and I'm going to apologize for that. I was meditating on the cost of running for re-election, particularly for offices such as yours, and until the senator pointed out the cost of the license plates, it occurred to me that substituting an individual senator or representative's image for Smokey Bear's on a license plate might be a fine fundraising opportunity for him. There are others from Benny who have serious remarks, but that was kind of the highlight of my testimony. I am interested in the Safe Routes to School bill. In addition to being mayor of the city of Bend, I'm also chair of the Bend Metropolitan Planning Organization, a member of Central Oregon Area Commission on Transportation, and a member of the Transportation Committee for both the League of Oregon Cities and the National League of Cities. So transportation is an area that I'm very much interested in. And as mayor and as the and speaking for the city council, we are supporting the Safe Routes to School bill. We have been supporting the Safe Routes to School as a concept since 2001 and continue to be. I would hope that if Safe Routes to School continues to be in the interminable considerations of the U.S. government concerning T21, that this bill in its final form, assuming that they get to that before everybody here retires, would be coordinated in some way. The idea of planning and for Safe Routes to School is really critical. Usually when we think about that, we simply think the sidewalks. It can conceivably be a lot more than that. There are some serious problems with besides sidewalks and the sidewalk problem in terms of the cost of planning and the cost of engineering and the cost of building is just out of the reach of most cities and certainly out of the reach of the city of Bend. We're a rapidly growing city, and as we annex and grow into areas that have been under prior county jurisdiction, those roads do not have sidewalks typically. And to retrofit those for new schools that are built in those areas is a very expensive proposition. So I would suggest that sidewalks is the major piece of it, but also the intersection of streets and school driveways where we have kids walking and parents driving and traffic on those streets is another serious problem that the Safe Routes to School bill can address, as well as the question of how do we get the funding to build pedestrian refuges and pedestrian safe crossings of the streets themselves in front of schools. One of the big shortages, and I'm not telling this committee anything they don't know, one of the big shortages of funds both at the state level and at the city level is for transportation operations. It's the potholes, it's the modifications to keep our streets safe for everybody. And this bill begins to address that. I'm not a fan of earmarking. And this looks like an earmark bill, but under certain circumstances, I think it's the proper way to go. This problem is so important, and the funding is so limited, that anything you can do in that respect is incredibly helpful. The one comment that I would have is that this bill and the way the funds are distributed looks at centralized distribution. And I would encourage you to look at some of the other aspects of transportation where the funding distribution is done down to the regions and through the regions, so that both the area commissions on transportation and the regional folks have an opportunity to set priorities. It would seem to me that this is another one of those places where getting advice from constituents throughout the state through the area commissions on transportation could well provide us with a better list than for all applications went to some kind of centralized authority in Salem. And thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Mayor. Now we have a panel. Scott, Brenda Johnson, Cheryl Howard, Al Alder, are you still here? And Jeff Munson?
I think we can talk about that license plate thing. Candy. I like that.
Chair Burley, members of the committee, Senator Wesson, thanks for having me back up here, but also I'm just hearing the Safe Routes to School bill. And as you see, sitting beside you, there's a lot of interest in Safe Routes to School, expressed by the mayor and other local community advocates, professionals who are in the school zone safety, so I think it's an appropriate place for this bill to have its first hearing. Thanks. I just want to spend a little bit of time, in regards to time, on explaining what we were trying to do in getting this bill out here, and I also want to thank the Transportation Committee for making this a bill that was sponsored by the Committee on Transportation. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance and the Wild Pedestrian Coalition have been working, as I mentioned earlier, to increase bicycling and walking to school. In 2001, we passed a bill that would effectively encourage school districts and cities to work together to plan for the barriers around bicycling and walking to school. And this bill adds on to that to provide funding to those communities to do that work. An important essential aspect of this work is a collaborative process and plan between school districts and cities. In my written testimony, I've outlined some challenges, and I think the folks here will deal with that. There's been a drastic decrease in bicycling and walking among children from 66% in 1970 to 8% today. Overweight children, kids, there's a variety of issues that I've listed here. Again, I think this panel will be able to talk about that. In Oregon, there's been a great interest in Safe Routes to School, and I listed a number of communities that are interested in working on it, have been working on it. In fact, the city of Bend and folks in the city of Bend are one of the early pioneers in Oregon. They already have at least one comprehensive school traffic safety program plan that was planned with the schools, and I think we'll have to talk more about that. I want to go straight to the bill now. The intention of the bill, as we've tried to draft this bill, is to provide a program, a central program at the ODOT, the Oregon Department of Transportation, Transportation Safety Division, that would coordinate a grant program to local communities. So effectively, if there was Safe Routes to School funding, either from the federal transportation reauthorization bill or through some other source, some other income source, that it would go into a central fund, it would be managed by the ODOT Traffic Safety Division, and it would be given out to local communities via grants. I think that, as we mentioned here earlier, there is a dire need by local communities for funding for their programs. Our concern is that that $2 million a year, which is the anticipated Safe Routes to Schools money that could come down from Congress if H.R. 3, which is the House of Representatives bill, would pass, that would build about 4 miles of sidewalk in Oregon. However, innovative solutions, whether it's pedestrian islands, school crossing guards, enforcement programs, some key sidewalk gaps that are identified by local communities, many of them are local streets, and we think that the community should have an opportunity to apply to the Transportation Safety Division to fill their needs. This bill, one catch this bill has is it requires school districts and cities to actually do the planning together, but it also provides funding for that. Many communities are interested in doing that. They don't have the resources. They can apply for a $30,000 grant. They can develop a collaborative partnership, such as you'll hear from today, and reapply for a grant to fund the top five priorities that come through that planning process. So I think this is an exciting concept. I also want to mention the Transportation Safety Division has an excellent record of providing grants and working with communities. They run the Safe Communities Program, which is funded by Debbie Hogan, who you heard before. They run a variety of other bicycle safety, pedestrian safety, DUI, many other grants around the state, so they're very used to this kind of operation. And I understand from them that this could cost about $30,000 to operate each year, and it would have no additional fiscal impact, no general revenue impact. And one of the things that we're actually looking at is whether or not this actually needs to go to Ways and Means, but I think it's another discussion to have with folks from the committee. So I appreciate my opportunity for me to testify, and hopefully I can pass it off to my colleagues. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Chairman Burley and members of the committee. My name is Brenda Johnson. I work at St. Charles Medical Center here in Bend, and I am also the chair of a task force that's been meeting for about a year here in Bend called the Healthy Active Central Oregon Task Force. We formed about a year ago to address the issue of obesity in our community and primarily around childhood obesity. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the impacts of physical activity for children who may be overweight or obese. I want to begin my testimony by just reading a couple of sentences from a quote made by Dr. David Satcher, who is the Surgeon General's call to action to prevent and decrease overweight and obesity in 2001. I quote, "Many people believe that overweight and obesity is a personal responsibility. To some degree, they are right, but it is also a community responsibility. When there are no safe and accessible places for children to play or adults to walk, jog, or ride a bike, it is a community responsibility," and there's more to that definition. But childhood obesity is a nationwide epidemic at this point, and good nutrition and regular physical activity are key to raising healthy children. The National Institutes of Health indicate that sedentary lifestyles and unhealthy eating habits contribute to about 20 different disease processes: cancer, heart disease, hypertension, diabetes. Trends in childhood obesity over the last 30 years: preschool children and adolescents, it has doubled the rates of obesity. For children aged 6 to 11, the rates have tripled. And there's a lot of reasons why that has happened, but one of the primary things is lack of opportunities for physical activity. It's estimated that about 9 million children over the ages of 6 in our nation are obese. It has significant health impacts, not only physical health, but also social and emotional health. And the economic costs are huge when we think about the children that are growing up now and the health, the diseases that they're going to get later on in their lives if they're not encouraged to be active right now. And so our task force is fully supporting this initiative, and because of the fact that children, you know, often it's considered not safe for them to walk or ride their bike to school. We don't have PE in school anymore, or not enough. So there's a variety of reasons why this epidemic is happening. But our task force would just like to support this initiative and encourage safe routes for all children in our community to be able to walk or bike to school. And on the other hand, their parents as well. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. Thank you for coming to Bend.
I'm Jeff Munson. I'm the executive director for the agency Commute Option for Central Oregon. This is a nonprofit agency that's been around for 15 years now, promoting bicycle, walking, carpooling, riding a bus. And the big emphasis of our programs, of course, is working with school children. And my part of the panel here is to tell you a little bit about some of the local grassroots efforts that are underway right now in our area. But Chair Burley in particular would be interested in what's happening in Bend and the others on the committee. As the mayor mentioned, we've been working on this for about 4 years now. And in particular, the last probably 6 months, we've been having some intensive meetings made up of a coalition, which I have listed here, the City of Bend, Deschutes County, Bend Lapine Schools, the Neighborhood Associations, Bend Police Department, Kids Safe Kids Coalition, and Commute Options. And there's a great deal of interest in the bill that you're looking at today. It's something that we feel that it's extremely important to promote this cause. We are working now with two elementary schools in Bend, Juniper and Bear Creek Elementary School. The principals are extremely interested in the program. And the next step that we're going to be working on is actually having what they call the safety walkabouts, where you go with the principals, the members of our committee, parents, students, and go to the schools at 3:30 in the afternoon after school and actually walk the routes that the kids take morning and afternoons on their way to and from school. And so we're going to take a look at, it might just be a barking dog in the neighborhood that's scaring kids from walking in that area. Could be a more expensive fix, but we want to assess the neighborhoods around the areas of these schools to see what action needs to be taken to make it a safer place where we can encourage more kids to walk and bike to school. So it's an extremely important bill. We appreciate your support and listening to our testimony today. Thank you very much.
Sorry, Cheryl. No problem. Cheryl, I'm the Youth Coordinator for Central Oregon for Kids. It's an organization that focuses accidental and permanent childhood injuries, 3 to 14 years old. I have just a few sticking points from material that they've provided. A function and activity of the Safe Kids organization is to promote participation in the International Walk to School Day, which takes place each October. This event consists of walking school buses that include children, parents, law enforcement, and local officials. The intent of this event is to promote daily walking school buses, Walk and Bike Wednesdays, and other programs that encourage children to walk or bike to school. The International Walk to School Day provides an opportunity to bring pedestrian safety issues to the attention of drivers. This event provides participants the opportunity to see challenges pedestrians face when walking, making them more conscientious drivers when they are driving. And statistics show that children are safer in numbers and along routes when motorists anticipate them. The International Walk to School Day also encourages those who normally drive to experience the walking environment. Walking to school reduces the number of cars in their schools and at pickup and drop-off times, which makes it safer for those who walk and reduces traffic congestion. 30 years ago, more than 66% of all children walked to school. Currently, only 13% of American children walk or bike to school. Per 100 million student trips, 45% ride in a car driven by an adult, 25% ride in a school bus, 14% ride in a car driven by a teen, 12% walk, 2% bike, and 2% ride another bus. One in four Oregon students is currently overweight. Central Oregon's first participation in the International Walk to School Day was in October of 2003. Of the 600-plus students at Bend's Juniper Elementary School, over 400 children participated. The problem is this. We had hoped to participate in this event in years prior to 2003, but could not do so as adequate sidewalks did not exist. Therefore, this event potentially presented a danger to our children until such time as we had some of the sidewalks needed constructed. These conditions, the lack of sidewalks and bike lanes, dissuade children from walking to school daily. These conditions still currently exist at many of our local schools. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
I have a quick question for Scott. Scott, do you know how much the federal government threw trillions of dollars at Salt Lake City and you did all those marvelous things with the flags and the islands and the bells and the audio signals. Do you know how much was spent in Salt Lake City on what you call, you know, kid-friendly or people-friendly walking transportation?
Chair Burley, Senator, I am not familiar with that number. Actually, I could do a little, if you want me to do a little checking on that specific project. I know the federal government does have a couple of programs here and there where they give the community a bunch of money to do a bunch of improvements and see do things change. And that's actually the Safe Routes to School program was funded in Marin County here, and it's a grant, and that was very successful there. I'm not familiar with the number. I can potentially do a little bit of checking if you're interested.
Yeah, I mean, you might want to just do some digging, because they not only did the downtown corridors and the big tourist, you know, traffic areas, but Salt Lake was smart. You said, well, okay, if you're going to do that, then you got to go out where suburban areas or neighborhoods and do some street safety sidewalks. So, I mean, so it's pretty cool. Really.
Just to follow up, Chair Burley and our members, Committee Senator, I think the Safe Routes program, where we're looking at potential $2 million to spend around the state, is only sort of a little small bite of the total problem. But I think what you'll find is communities get this kind of resources that this is a growing need of the communities, and they'll be asking for additional resources, and hopefully we can find more than just the federal government. Thank you.
The question I had was, in the initial draft, there's Section 2, Sub 2, that a city, county, or school district that has participated in the development of the plan, et cetera, et cetera, may apply to the department for assistance in carrying out the plan. And I don't know about other communities, but I know that here our then Metro Partner Recreation District has been a very active, integral partner in this whole program, and I think we might want to consider expanding that list to include special districts in cases like that.
Okay. Chair Burley, my understanding is the way that the 2001 bill was drafted is that it included, and again, this came from the council, of course, that it included under ORS 174.109 government agencies, which on the second page of my testimony, I wrote it here somewhere. Let me see if I can find it. I have it here. So applications will come from local public bodies, include state, local, and special government bodies. So I don't know if park districts include that. I think they actually might. So perhaps this sub 2 needs to just more clearly reference and hear that. Okay, appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've
got four more. Would you mind coming up as a panel together? Dr. Cooten, Jim Roderick, Mike Lovely, and Deborah Easton here.
Should I proceed?
Hi, this is Dr. Jim Cooten, and welcome to Central Oregon. I was amused by Senator Westland's remarks about the lawnmower gas money, and I would like to remind him, I know he's very passionate about saving the Oregon Health Plan. Please don't give all that money, gas money, away.
It's not ours. It's not yours. It's the people who paid the tax who are eligible to reclaim it. And
anyway, I am the ORMA trustee from Central Oregon, VP nominee for the ORMA, and I speak on behalf of myself, my colleague, Dr. Alan Merritt, who was the physician citizen of the year 2003, for which Senator Jim Westland wrote a glowing accommodation, and primarily for Jim Lace, who's the chair of the ORMA Legislative Committee, and he has submitted this letter on behalf of his status from the Oregon Pediatric Society and the Oregon Medical Association in strong support of Safe Routes to School. And Jim Lace is a pediatrician in Salem, has been practicing for 28 years. He deals with the issue of childhood obesity on a daily basis and has watched the current epidemic of childhood obesity grow before his eyes. Currently in the U.S., about 16% of children under the age of 2 are obese and about 30% are overweight. About 65% of adults are overweight 1% are obese. This epidemic of obesity shows no signs of slowing down and is on track to replace tobacco usage as the number one killer in the category of preventable diseases. The state of Oregon spends about $200 million a year in treating diseases caused by obesity. What does this bill have to do with childhood obesity? Many children do not get enough exercise. In some parts of the state, there are not enough safe routes that these children can follow when they go to school on which they can ride or walk or ride their bikes. We need to develop safe routes to encourage these children to walk or ride. This bill can be part of an overall scheme to begin to reduce our obesity epidemic. Obesity predisposes an individual to many diseases, including diabetes type 2, hypertension, arthritis, joint replacement, liver disease, dyslipidemia, asthma, sleep apnea, obstructive airway disease, early heart disease, and stroke and depression. Obese children do worse in school than their non-obese peers. The current generation of children will be the first generation of children who will die at a younger age than their parents because of obesity issues. We need our children to get more exercise. Please vote yes on this bill.
Thank you. Deborah, you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I just briefly wanted to touch on two points that have not been mentioned. The city of Bend has developed 5 safe route to school plans to gather the funding and resources available, and I think this speaks to the commitment of the city to this program. We've also developed a template that we can use for schools that don't have a plan and some guidelines on how to develop a plan. We'd be more than happy to share that with anyone in the state who's interested in just meeting with the planning portion from the city or county perspective. I wanted to also emphasize my experience with the Transportation Safety Division and the State Communities Program. In 1996, the City of Bend received a National Highway Traffic Safety Administration grant of $100,000 per year to run a safe communities program. That was administered through the Transportation Safety Division under Troy Gustalis. The grant came to the City of Bend for 4 years. At the end of that time period, we were successful in getting the city to pick up the funding for that program completely. It has now been incorporated as an institution within the city. I think this is an example of how effective grant funding should function. And I'm in hopes that if the Safe Route to School program is funded in a similar manner, that we will soon not have to have a hearing like this and make it a law, that it will be an institutional part of our government in the state of Oregon.
Representative Burley and committee, thanks for being here. I'm getting addicted to these out-of-Salem get-togethers, and I'll probably be seeing you tomorrow. For the record, I'm Mike Lovely. Amongst other things, I am president of the Southwest Bend Neighborhood Association. I am very much in favor of the St. Drops to School. We have 2 new schools, elementary schools, that are never there. And presently, they are busing children within walking distance of school because of the crosswalks and lack of sidewalks. And I would like to see maybe use some lottery funds for some of these crosswalks. And another thing, when they're talking about the flashing lights, I was sitting there jotting notes and something else popped into my mind, and we have a couple of those fixtures already in use in the city of Bend. Solar-powered flashing lights, and why can't we put a motion detector on the sidewalk? It won't be affected by the traffic. It'll be affected by foot traffic. And when people are in that area of the sidewalk, the flashing light comes on, and it's not. If you have a flashing light all the time, people are not going to pay attention to it. But if it flashes when somebody's there, and you have the, when children are present, then bingo, it goes on. And it gets rather frustrating sometimes when legislation and rules are always geared to the lowest common denominator dummy. And this is something that would be flexible. You wouldn't have to worry about electricity. You don't have to worry about somebody turning it on. I think it's something worth looking into. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're saying, Mike, even you could work that, that wouldn't be too much of a problem.
Right. Okay. And for the record, I am not overweight. I am vertically challenged. and I like your brakes.
Yes, thank you.
Chairman Burley, Senator, members of the committee, this is Heinrich. My name is Jim Roderick. I'm the transportation supervisor for the Lyon Public Schools. I just wanted to cite a couple of things. You did mention those two new communities that you should be aware of. That's Pine Ridge and Ensworth. And they're both designed for 300 students in very populated areas. And we are now having the bus, both of them, Pine Ridge in particular. I'm busing about a third of that population now. The school district here is about 13,000. I bus roughly 61% of that. I'm on several committees with Deborah here. I'm also on the Safe Routes to School representing the school district. And I don't see much walking at all, to tell you the truth. Busing is 1 mile if you're elementary, a mile and a half if you're middle and high school. I see an awful lot of cars to these elementary schools hauling these kids in because of that mile, but also I think if they had a way to get there other than just being driven by a family or a relative of the family, I think that would be a big help. The other help would be buses that get on an average of, in my fleet, 6 miles to the gallon with the OPEC crunch. Over $2 per gallon, and that's going to try out a big budget you people are working on. That would help that quite a bit. And that's all I have to say. Thank you. Thank you for coming here.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mayor Unger, I apologize. I missed you earlier, but we're just saving the best for last.
Well, I apologize. I was up talking with Commissioner Bailey about the state land thing we're working on next week. For the record, my name is Alan Unger, Mayor of Redding, and part of Central Oregon Cities Organization, Chair Burley and Committee. Support of safe school routes has been a priority for Central Oregon Cities Organization in the past and in the present. Every community needs to address safe school routes. Missing sidewalks, dangerous street crossings, lack of lighting, signing are all challenges for children. I know the Redding School District does not use busing if you live within 1 mile of the school, so those children all either need to walk or find their own way to school. I think a collaboration between cities, counties, school districts, special districts, with the help of the state and ODOT would create solutions. A combination of local and state and other monies will help this program be successful. I know I think Redding has applied for state federal money to address some sidewalk needs, and that could be part of the mix, and that could just help us. But I appreciate you bringing this up and having it be a concern. Thank you.
Questions? Well, I'll close this public hearing, and I want to thank everybody for your patience and perseverance and sticking around this morning. Those of you on the phone, thank you very much. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
A very safe trip to Baker tomorrow. And with that, we are adjourned.
Mike, what are you talking about? I think it means Monday.
Monday.